I couldn't stop drinking. I was drinking over 2 quarts a day, and there was no way I could live without drinking. And he convinced me that I could go a day without a drink, showed me how, took him through it, and over the years has been my inspiration and my sponsor. Clancy?
My name is Clancy Amos Lerner. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. Glad to be safe and sane and sober, because I didn't used to be, and I may not be again sometime, because some awful good guys have gone down the toilet after being safe and sane and sober for a long time. But I'm glad to be in this room. This is my home group meeting tonight, and I make it a point to sit there. I do not take speaking engagements on Wednesday night. Just one night a year. That's to come down here. I sit over here with this gentleman sitting. I can visualize Chuck C., my sponsor for many years, looking at me disapprovingly, wondering how I'm going to embarrass him this year. There's 3 seats right in there. You care? Now you, back to the steps. That's the first example I've ever seen of anyone on the Laguna Beach on the steps. I don't want to give you a justified resentment. But I'm glad to be here. I'm glad my friends came down with me. I was thinking, you know, I'm from a little town up in northern Wisconsin. I came from Norwegian background, kind of dummies. And I thought, I really got the learned this year again. I was speaking in Oslo in June. And I visited again the farm my grandparents came from in the 1880s. And I suddenly realized why I've had so much difficulty in life. You know, in the 1880s and 90s, all sorts of young Norwegians left Norway to come to the United States to get away from that climate. And they all settled in North Dakota and Minnesota and Wisconsin. And they've been sitting there 60 years saying, yeast, this is cold, you too. You know, kind of thing. That's the mindset I have to overcome every morning. But I was thinking about my friends, the distinguished people I brought with me, my car. Now, if you're kind of new, it's kind of impressive. You wouldn't know, you couldn't tell which one is which, but one of them is a distinguished guy who came off the beach, a bum, a loser, without any hope. Now the owner, president, founder of a multi-million dollar... of a multi-million dollar corporation, and a very good man and generous and kind. Another man with me is a man who came frightened and alone from a garage where he was living, and now has over the years become a salesman, been married and married and married and but now a partner in a very excellent law firm in Los Angeles, and just he and his partner are doing wonderfully well, and they're just proud of him. And another one is a speaker who's world famous, probably one of the most famous speakers in the whole world. His tapes are all over the world. And these 3 people were my car. And if you are new tonight, you might think, aren't you lucky to have them? Let me tell you what I have them with me for, to get me in the carpool lane. Because they're nothing. Get that through your head. But I am so glad to be here, and I know we have a lot of new people here tonight, and I'm sure as you look around, you wonder, what could I possibly have in common with these people? Incidentally, I want to thank Dr. Paul for getting me, he offered to get me some coffee tonight. And I never got it, but he offered. I guess he couldn't remember whether he'd made the prescription out or not. See, that's part of the story, you see. It's kind of I want to congratulate the birthday people, especially John, a distinguished man. And was it your 50th birthday, John? 49? I know it was 49 when you started talking. The first law of survival, never attack the man who's got the microphone next. Don't ever do that. But you may wonder what you have in common. It's like a big club and everybody seems to know each other and they wonder what people like you might be doing here who don't fit in, who don't feel well. And nearly everyone who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous has that feeling. It's hard to understand that when you're new. But what do you have in common? Some of these people tonight are old when they came. Some are young. Rosie, the girl I'm stalking. I better watch out. This is dangerous climate these days. I'm stalking that girl is what he's doing. I may be stalking her, but I couldn't do anything if I caught her, so it's all right. I may have mentioned this to some of you. You know, it's kind of, I've just turned 70 a couple years ago, and I'm 72 now, and so my doctor gives me iron, and I take a lot of iron for my blood and so on. But because of certain things, about a few months ago, I just thought for the fun of it, I'd try something I'd read about. I took a Viagra. And I had no idea, if you're taking iron, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now every 4 hours, I face north. I'm sorry I said that. But anyway. You may wonder what you have in common with all these people, and as rightfully so, I'm sure there are people who have been sober a while who could not establish a bond. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous is so important. In Chapter 3, over the years, I've worked in medical corporations, I've worked in radio and television, a lot of places, and for the last few years, I've taken it upon myself to work in a mission in Skid Row and run a mission on Skid Row for men and women who are dying of alcoholism. And I've always tried to keep up with the current amount of information on alcoholism and what the medical profession is finding out and so on. And it's an amazing thing, after all I've learned, still the best example, the best description of what people like me, and I presume like you have if you're here, is the first couple pages of Chapter 3 in the book, which I heard and read and many times and read it many times. I had absolutely no connection with it because I have a tendency to skim and wonder if there's going to be some big breakthrough. And what they talk about there, if you're new, what are the probably most of us have had in common, maybe all of us? Not how much we drank, or not what we lost, or what we gained, or what... But rather, one of the things is that, if you're like me, you have spent some time willfully or unintentionally laboring in that obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And it says in the book, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And you wonder, why would anybody do that when you're having trouble drinking? Why would you pursue it? We'll get into that in a little minute, but that's one of the things you and I have in common. There seem to be, as far as I've been able to gather, three general types of alcoholics, I suppose, that I know about. One is people who drink heavily, maybe drink a great deal, have alcoholic problems, and something graphic happens, something significant, the loss of someone, a very severe sickness, an accident, someone, a divorce, something, and they stop. They say, oh man, that stuff has eaten me up, and they don't drink anymore. And most of us have known people like that or have heard of people like that. Yes, he used to drink like you do, but he stopped. And then there are a type of alcoholic who drinks and becomes very addicted to alcohol, physiologically addicted. And these people are the kind that have to be usually taken off in a hospital situation. That's why hospitals such as Chick Shadell in Seattle can say we cure alcoholics in a week's residence. Not because they are withdrawn from alcohol. They say, look what you're doing to your life. And they say, wow, that's right. I don't want to do that anymore. And they don't drink. And then there's the kind like you and me which baffle our loved ones, baffle our employers, and baffle ourselves. We drink until something drastic happens and we quit. Or we drink till we become addicted and we get withdrawn. And we've learned our lesson. But inexorably always drink again. Much to my mysterious emotions, much to the people around me. And we all know that feeling. And you cannot explain it. People want explanations. Why did you drink? Look, you're just your family, your children, your job. And there's no answer. So your answer is, leave me alone. Get out of my face. Leave me alone. Because I don't know either, pal. And that's one of the things, somehow or other, I take on this consideration. I will somehow learn to drink. Why would I want to do that? Nothing else would you do that with. And it says, it goes on to say there are occasional brief recoveries. We find where, I think I got under control now, followed always by still worse relapse. It says, then you get to a point I've always, as a writer, I've always enjoyed this because it's such a tasty choice of words. Reaching a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I used to think when I read that, well, that's how drunk you get. You're just pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. But I've come to realize that isn't what they mean at all, I don't think. That's the way you feel after you sober up. After you come off the drunk, there's this pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and people want explanations, and I can't find one in myself. And then you maybe stop for a while or swear off with... Then there's a little thing in there, a little paragraph that ends that particular section of chapter 3. And people sometimes think it's funny. It's kind of cute to talk about things like people like you and me do. We don't drink whiskey anymore, drink beer only, or only drink at home, or never drink at home, or read spiritual literature, or take physical exercise, or go into sanitariums and hospitals, read the things, drink wine only, all sorts of things that people like me do. And I've done nearly all of those things. Why would anybody do such silly things? And that is the nubbin of the nature of our illness, and that's why most people like you and me will never, ever stay sober. Today in America, where there's more sobriety than anywhere in the history of the world, it's estimated that about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk as a direct result of drinking. A number of people in this room will die drunk, drive bad deaths. Not because it doesn't work, not because you're not sincere. Now, it might be me. My sponsor who taught me that, my first sponsor, said, if you don't do these things, you'll get drunk. And I said, yeah. But some years later, when he got mad at AA and stopped going to meetings and doing the things, and he eventually took pills, and the psychiatrist prescribed his pills, and then he eventually drank, and he died drunk, he convinced me. That's right. Because he knew much more about AA than I did. Well, why would this be? And that is the nature of why we get together in Alcoholics Anonymous, discuss this book, discuss these steps. That mystery, why would anybody drink alcohol when they know they've lost control of it and things are bad? It baffles everyone. It's something to do with being on Skid Row. I've watched that happen to people who are still making $1 million a year. A few years ago, I got a 12-step call up in Bel Air. A friend of mine, Maurice, had a famous writer up there, and I went up. The maid let me into the butler, who let me into the master bedroom, enormous bedroom, about half as big as this room, with white furnishings on the wall, the Academy Award and the New York Theater Critics Awards, and everything around the room. And everything just overpowering. Then he looked in the bed and saw a little huddled figure. They'd taken out his teeth so he wouldn't choke himself, crying. And Maurice and I talked to him for a while. We got him to go to a few meetings. And he had been in AA 12 years and written some of the great literature about AA, the theatrical literature. Come back a little Sheba and things like that. And finally got going to AA again, and he was felt as bad as I ever felt standing in front of a Skid Row mission with my teeth kicked out. You know, so often podiums are used to convey experiences that indicate that you haven't felt as bad as they have. I've been in the insane asylum. I've been in the insane asylum committed for an indefinite period after the rest of my life. I've received shock treatment after shock treatment after shock treatment. I've lost everything. How sad this... No. We all come here and I come to understand you can only feel as bad as you can feel. And I'm convinced everyone in this room has felt as bad as I have felt, and I felt as bad as you felt. You can only feel so bad as you feel. And that guy in that bedroom felt as bad, and he had everything in the world that most of us would think would bring happiness. And I remember he did very well for 4 or 5 months, and he did well, came to our meetings, took part. And one day, Maurice called me and says, you better call Bill. I think he's kind of withdrawing. So I called him up. I says, you going to any meetings, Bill? He said, well, no. He said, I'm not. This was on a Friday. He said, my psychiatrist thinks I'm getting too dependent on AA. And I said, I hope so. But he said, no, I don't. I said, you can't do that, Bill. You got to do something about it. He said, no, you don't understand, Clancy. I know you mean well, but it's a little bit different for people in my position. And so the next day we tried to get him to come to the Saturday night meeting. He said, I'm going to sit home today and think things out, and I'll work it out, and I'll be in touch. And we looked up paper Sunday morning, front page of the Times. William Inge puts a bullet through his head. He thought it all night long and finally blew his head off because he stopped doing the things that kept people like him and me sober and you sober. And that doesn't mean you have to become a fanatic, but the problem is how, if my problem is alcohol, what's this other stuff about? What is all these steps and religion and crap? And I could not accept these things, and that's why I slipped in AA year after year. The worst years of my life came after people taught me about AA and took me to meetings and showed me what to do. And after a while, I could just freeze them out. I could just freeze them out. I know you mean well, but the great line that people like me use, and you use if you're new, I know you mean well, but I don't think you really understand. My case is different. Sounds funny, but it really isn't funny at all. My case is different. Why is my case different? I look back now, and I don't know if I could have explained it at the time, but I can explain it now because I see it in retrospect. My case was different because my problem wasn't alcohol. That's simple. I'd been in and out of AA for 9, 10 years, and I'd been in meetings, and I'd done fairly well. I was working in a college faculty, and I was a university faculty, and I directed a grand opera at University of Texas, and I'd worked in Tracy Locke, helping write the L.C. Nellenrise for the board and company, and I'd been somewhat successful, and I'd gone to AA, and I'd spent many thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis. I've done a lot of things. And I know these simple people mean well when they say, well, if you just turn over your life to the program and do good things, it'll be all right. I'm sure it does that for many people. But you don't understand. My case is different. Why is my case different? My problem isn't alcohol. My problem is that I have terrible sensitivities, that I feel things intensely. That I have terrible feelings of rejection sometimes. I have terrible feelings of resentment. I have feelings of I don't fit in. I feel that feelings don't understand what about me. I have feelings that I'm not enough somehow. Other times I have feelings I'm too good. I'm either superior or inferior, but never the same, never equal. I'm above them or below them. I resent and envy the people that are above me, and I have contempt for the people who are below me. And I just, the operative phrase of my life, is this is not it either. This job, this woman, this town, this nothing. God, I thought this was it, but it isn't, and worse off. Because I guess one of the things I look at my life, I wanted things to be wonderful. And I'll tell you a bad piece of news if you're new. It sounds bad, it really isn't, but it sounds bad at first. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. No love, no job, no car, no nothing. No matter how nice your car is, one day you come out of just the car. One day the job, just that damn job. And on and on. In fact, one of the things that is somewhat difficult when you're working with new people, and they all are rather lonely sometimes, and you hear that operative phrase that just sends a shiver down sponsors' backs. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. If you can, you put the phone on the uh-huh machine and... and pretty soon they're saying, but I know that I thought it was the last one, but this is the one, I swear to God, I tell you. When I saw her walking out of detox that morning... I had to clench her. We were having lunch and we reached for the salt and our fingers touched and there was a spark. I swear to God, I saw a spark. And you don't have to tell them the facts of life yet or let them find out. You know, this is not in what you call your basic Romeo and Juliet situation. This is a crazy puke with an infatuation. And in fact, it isn't going to last long, but in the case one in a billion that your relationship would last over 30 minutes, you know, you could, if it turns into love, which it may or may not, 3 years from now, you may be sitting with this lovely girl in your own little house with a white picket fence outside and your little child playing on the sofa. And you'll be having lunch and you'll reach for the salt and your fingers will touch and you'll say, give me the goddamn salt. Just part of life. It's just part of life. Just part of life. But people like me want things to stay wonderful, and they don't stay wonderful, and so I know that drinking enhances my feelings. And I try to do something about it. I want to be good. All my life, I was trained in the Norwegian Lutheran Church to be a good man. My idol was a bronze Viking god somewhere who once strode through the world doing good, raping and pillaging Ireland and other good things. Yeah. The hardest thing for Vikings to remember, I think, was pillage before you burn. Pillage before you burn. But I turned out to be a weak, sinner, bad man, I thought. And I didn't know what to do. And I know that when I drink, things get... Drinking does more for me than... I'll tell you, 3 martinis make me feel better than 6 years of psychoanalysis. Than anything. It just... I feel like I'm enough. I feel like I'm worth something. I can... Verbal. I don't feel so out of it. And then sometimes I drink too much and people think my problem is alcohol. And I thought it was when I first went to AA in 1949, a long time ago. And I was 22 years old. I started drinking in the Pacific Ocean as a runaway from home when I was 15, early in the Second World War. And I didn't become a terrible drunk, but drinking made me feel like a man. And I went to AA, and AA is a nice place, but it isn't for people like me. It's for people who have a drinking problem. I don't know what you young people today in AA hear. I'm sure they think they hear what I heard in 1949. Some old fool in his 40s with gray hair saying things like, I stayed drunk around the clock for 40 years. One day I walked through that door. They told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I just never felt so goddamn happy. And you feel, well, that helps you, pal, but it doesn't help me. So I went to AA, and I did a lot of things. And finally, one day, I found myself in a situation that a person of my background and intelligence and ability and success cannot be in. Two big guys were throwing me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and said, and stay out of here, you damn bum. And I tried to explain to them, I'm not a bum. But I couldn't get it out. If some man would have come up to me, I stood in the rain that morning, a cold rain, on the street corner, and if some guy had come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 125 pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your clothes somewhere. Don't know where they are, but all you got left is what you got on, and they're dirty and torn. It's a nice suit, but it's dirty and torn and wet. You've lost your front teeth. I had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix jail in a terrible, terrible evening thing. I'd been thrown in there drunk and got sick, and I vomited on a guy's bunk, and he's so mad he kicked up my trunk, he let me lay on the floor in my own blood. He said, now you've been going to AA now for 10 years. Why don't you just go back one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and do something about it before you die? And if my life depended on being honest, if I had to be honest, I'd had to tell him, it isn't the way it looks, pal. I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. I know there's something terribly wrong with me. I've known it since I was a little boy. There's something wrong inside of me. But it isn't alcohol, because alcohol is one of the few things that makes it better. And sometimes I drink too much and people think it's alcohol, but you don't understand. And I had no idea what was wrong with me. But later that day, I remember some guy had taken me to an AA club a week before that and dropped me off, and I finally left again. I walked 71 blocks out to an AA club to get out of the rain. I went in this dumb club full of AA fanatics and crazy people that I felt, and back to that same old juvenile, go to a lot of meetings, work the steps on the wall and the traditions and all these hokey statements and simpletons running them. And I hung around that thing, and I went to a meeting that night and ate about 4 pounds of cake and listened to somebody talking about Jesus or somebody I didn't like. And that night I slept in an abandoned car, Joe Quinn's abandoned car that he left in the parking lot a few months before. Next morning I got up, it was Sunday morning, I had a spiritual meeting, even worse, I ate 4 pounds of cake, kept raining. That night I went to a meeting and ate more pounds of cake, sat around and listened to these idiots. And I really thought I was dead. I thought, I must have died. This must be hell. This is just an eternity of listening to people tell me about AA. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date. Because I'd gotten sober with dedication and devotion and belief early on. And I did it for my family, I did it to stay out of shock people, I did it for my jobs. And now I had no reason to stay sober. Because the one time I went to the insane asylum, I stayed sober too long. And the reason I stayed sober, because my son had died when I was in jail. And I felt so bad about that I went on the wagon and swore never to drink. And one day it got so bad I couldn't stand it. And I couldn't drink, so I'd taken a vow in his casket. So when my wife and children went to church, I pulled the car in the garage and hooked up the hose and went to sleep and died. And they put me in the Texas State Insane Asylum as a schizophrenic, paranoid tendencies. And people said, are you an alcoholic? I said, no, I'm not. There's something wrong with me. I don't know what it is. I know drinking eases it off. If it weren't for alcohol, I'd be a suicide. So what is my problem? I'm glad that I survived a while. I'm glad that I fell in with that group of AA fanatics. You know, if you're new tonight, you'll hear that a lot. Stick with the winners. Stick with the winners. Who are the winners here? Well, it's hard to tell. They don't wear signs. Some of them are hard to tell that they're winners. But one of the ways, I'll tell you who I think the winners are. People have been sober the longest. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're not. I know old timers, and so do you, that used to be crackerjack AAs, but are now just old, dry, negative, poisonous people. I stay away from those people. They got nothing to tell me. So who are the winners? Well, as far as I can determine, the winners are the people who came here feeling as bad as you or I ever did, whether they came in a limo or came walking up the street. And they allowed themselves to be guided into taking actions that didn't seem to have any application to their problem as they perceived it. And taking these actions over a period of time, their perceptions changed, and they start to feel better, and they start to realize why they're here, and the answer to the problem we had earlier, what's it about? And they come, and they're the people who are on these meetings on a continuing basis. And they also say, stay away from the losers. Who are the losers? Hard to tell sometimes because they're kind of fun people sometimes. And they really are. They're fun people. I've known there's several people in this room that are losers that I know have had a lot of fun with them, but they can't stay sober. So what do they say? What do they say? How do you know a loser? I don't know. I can't tell. But I'll tell you a phrase. If you hear them say this, stay away from them. Oh, you don't have to do all those things. You don't have to do all that stuff your sponsor's saying. That's just podium talk. Because they literally can kill you. I know that because I used to say that to people when I hung around AA. I'd hang around AA for a while until I got tired of it, and I'd talk two or three newcomers and getting drunk with me. And that's the hardest thing in my amends. I can't go back to Logan Square in Chicago and say, well, the two guys and the girl I took out of here down to the Logan Square Lounge in 1950, I'm sorry, I hope you all got back. Or the two girls and the guy I took out of the San Francisco Alano Club or the out-of-town North Club in Dallas. But these people can literally destroy you, it doesn't seem like it. Well, why do you want to stay with these winners? Why do you want to stay with the winners? And I'll tell you why. Because in most, nearly every case, they are the activists in AA. They are the people who are doing the things. So what? Well, it turns out for people like me, and I presume like you, when you don't have much going for you, and you can't see to the time, but in retrospect you can see it, you're like a chameleon. You take on the coloration of your surroundings. And if they're doing things, you do them, whether you intend to or not. You just do them. Mm-hmm. A guy called to my attention a while back, and I remember it vaguely, standing outside of the AA club, 5 weeks sober, and thinking to myself, I've had enough with these damn meetings. I've been going to meetings, and I know they don't help people like me. I got to get some money. I got to hold up a 7-Eleven, maybe get some teeth, get some clothes. I'd go to New York. I'd get a job as a writer, and I wouldn't be treated like crap like I'm being treated by these people. Some of these people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn last year, and now they're giving me a bunch of crap. No more meetings. I'm going to get on the ball. My fancy time to get in the car and go to the meeting. Come on, fancy. We're going to help Fred move his furniture. Oh, shit. On and on. These people pulled me along until I stayed sober well. And then you get to the next step in your education of how you solve this problem. They want you to get a sponsor. If you're going to get a sponsor, you've got to be very careful. Sponsors have a tendency to stick their nose in your business. And I've had sponsors over the years, the brief times I've been around A, but I saw this guy come into the 6300 Club, and he was an actor. He always played loving roles in the movies. His name was Bob Bailey. He was always lending people money and help giving people a hand. That's my new sponsor. I'll get some money, get some teeth. I'll be out of here in a New York minute. I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? He said, yes, I will, but I want you to do what I say. Oh, sure, Bob. I'm sincere. I look back and I realize that old guy should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played. Because they were foreign to his nature, I'll tell you. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Jesus. Now, I'm often look back and thought, why would I take that crap? Because my whole style is I don't take crap from anybody. I'm working at a big job at an advertising agency. Somebody gives me some crap and implies I'm not enough. Okay, get yourself another void, dumbbell. I'm out of here. If I'm in a bar, somebody says, you don't look so tough to me. Don't you think so? Why don't you try me, son of a bitch? Come on.
I don't take crap from anybody. And I look back years later, I realize why I didn't take crap from anybody. Because down deep, I know I'm a weakling. And I can't bear to let anybody find it out. I'll fight, I'll quit, I'll do anything, but you won't know I'm a weakling, boy. It's a funny thing, if you stay in AA a while, it's an amazing thing. You can become strong here. Then you can afford to be weak. But when you're weak, you can't afford to be weak. You gotta be strong. But this guy gave me crap, and I used to think, why would I take that crap from him? I look back and think, do you know who I liked? I liked people who liked me. I had no respect for them. I thought they were idiots. But I liked them. I hated people who could see through me because they knew I was a phony and I was weak, and I hated that. And he could see through me, so I hated him. But he liked me too. And I did things to win approval from that old boob that I wouldn't have done for anybody. And little by little, he got me to take actions that I thought were stupid. And eventually I survived. And I survived finally long enough to get a glimmering of why I was doing these things. I stayed sober a while without ever knowing it. That's what you may have to do if you're new. The breakthroughs you find out here may not be accurate at all. But the number one thing you new people and I have to first learn, and then we got to remember, is why I am here. Why I am here. To get off alcohol? Yeah, I guess so, one way or another. To become a better person? I suppose. That's one of the things you do, I suppose, little by little. But what is the point? How could I be here? How could I be an alcoholic? Tonight I got up here and I said, my name is Clancy Imslin and I'm an alcoholic. When did I become an alcoholic? I wasn't an alcoholic when I drank. I wasn't an alcoholic when I got sober. Did I get a touch by a fire somewhere along the line? Not at all. I'll tell you when I learned began to glimmer I was an alcoholic. When I'd been around here a while, feeling put upon, feeling hurt, feeling my life was over, taking actions that I knew to be inane and way beneath my intellectual level, truly, and finally, little by little, stumbling on to things I'd never had known, but I guess didn't know anymore, discovering that my feeling, my problem can't be alcohol because my problem is not alcohol. To discover this book says exactly the same thing. Who would have thought that AA said the problem is not alcohol? So what is the problem, you might say? Of course the problem is alcohol. Everybody knows that. You can disprove that in 5 seconds if you think about it. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. Hospitals, jails. They turn out sober people with varying amounts of information on what may be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee you, if they be like me and what they call in our book, our type of alcoholic, you will come to discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. And you know no one really understands. And the time must come when sooner or later I must drink your sedate. Sometimes, as our book says, you would have believed they'd say this, sometimes I have to drink to preserve my sanity. That's how bad it gets. And yet they say for you to drink to go insane, but for me not to drink is to kill myself. Okay, so what is this problem? It's not alcohol. Is it some form of deep psychic dissatisfaction? Do we have to send in and get new videos every couple months or learn new things? Everyone in this room, the newest person, already knows what's wrong with you, but you don't know you know it. The problem here sounds like alcohol and is awfully confused with alcohol. It is called alcoholism. You say, well, that's the same thing, for God's sakes. Alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. Significantly different. I'll guarantee you, if you be an alcoholic of our type, the day will come when your existence and your sanity will depend on remembering the difference. So what's the difference? Well, I could talk about that for 2 hours, I guess, because it's easy to talk about it. But go back to what I just said a minute ago. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. Alcoholism, this strange thing that looks the same to the naked eye, usually, this perception-distorting, mind-consuming, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing, has not helped by stopping drinking. It makes it worse. So, eventually, sober alcoholics of our type are in a position where they drink or go mad, or drink or commit suicide, or drink or just run away or do something. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. One other thing must be present. You must be one of the 6 or 7 or 8% of people, apparently, in the world, and nobody knows why to this day, who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. The book, when they were groping for words, called it an allergy of the body. But it's called an unnatural reaction to alcohol. So what's this unnatural reaction to alcohol? We should stay drunk all the time? Nah. Nobody can stay drunk all the time. Makes you act crazy? Well, then I broke out of Sing Sing and raped 9 nuns and went to Menninger Clinic. That's just flash. Do you know what it is, the thing that makes an alcoholic like you and me, an alcoholic of our type? It's not what alcohol does to us at all. It's what alcohol does for us. What makes the 6 or 7 or 8% of people unusual is that alcohol does something special for them it doesn't do for most people. And what is that? It almost instantly makes everything all right. It doesn't do that for most people. I didn't know it didn't do it for all people. That's why I couldn't understand people who didn't want to drink. And the people it doesn't do it for can't understand why I do. And we will never be in the same path. But I know that my case is different and you don't understand. And I know when it's bad enough, long enough, a few drinks. In fact, when you get near the end, if you keep going, and you may, I hope you don't because it gets worse and worse, you'll find winding up drinking to forget your drinking. Which sounds funny, maybe in the Rotary Club, but it isn't funny here. You don't really drink to forget your drinking, but drinking is causing you terrible problems, and the only solution you have left to terrible problems is having a few drinks. And so you wind up drinking and trying to stay sober. And you don't stay drunk. In fact, that's one of the curses of alcoholism. You get sober. You can't stay drunk. If you could stay drunk, you'd be better off. But you got to get sober. But you can't stay sober, so you got to get drunk. Or drink anyway to relieve it. And you can't keep drinking, so you got to get sober. With or without a solemn oath, then you drink, then you get sober. And nobody seems to understand. They say, if you quit drinking, but you don't understand, I quit drinking, for Christ's sake, I killed myself, you don't understand. And that phenomenon is called alcoholism. And it doesn't make a difference if you're making $1 million a year, or you're standing outside where I work on Skid Row, about 10 minutes from death. It's the same proposition. And it's subject to great denial. Nothing that I know is subject to more denial. You can't deny narcotic addiction. That's quite obvious. Can't deny a lot of things. But you can die. Over the years, I've had, I guess, 3 guys I've sponsored who have died from cancer. They've all died in the UCLA hospital, in the hospice ward. Nothing to do with the UCLA hospital. It just happened to be convenient where we are. And I go up there and I go up there after work and sit with these people. I hate and sit in the hospice. But that's what sponsors are supposed to do, I suppose. But I remember sitting here one night and my friend Ramon Pena was dying. I looked around that board and they just changed the guy in this bed. He died, the one that had been there yesterday. He was gone and somebody else was new. And they're dying all around me. He's going to be dead soon. And I sit there thinking, what would these guys in this ward do if I said to them, hey, got a deal for you. Would you come with me every night at 8 o'clock, meet some new people, hear some kind of interesting speakers, talk about how you feel even? Drink some coffee, make some friends, have some laughs. Would you do that every night if I could cure your cancer? They would sign over their homes to you. They'd take everything. Oh, God, do it. Maybe the worst place I've ever been psychologically. It doesn't smell bad. It doesn't look bad. It just is a bad place. That's the Los Angeles County Hospital Charity Ward for AIDS, where they're not only dying, but they're being thrown. They've been thrown away. And I had a guy in there. I had helped, and he was dying of AIDS. I went in there, I remember, it was like being Molokai, must have been like in the days of the lepers. And I thought to myself, what would these guys in this ward say if I said, hey, got a deal for you guys. Would you do some things that don't even make sense? Come around here, come with me, and maybe let me tell you what to do for a little while, and maybe after a while, write down some of the rotten things you never told anybody, and read them to me, maybe, and maybe go on to some people you've screwed over and make it up to them, even though you feel guilty and bad. And we should try to help some other people like this. Would you know that if we could cure your AIDS, they would crawl across the floor and lick your feet. But you go down 2 floors to the acute alcoholic ward where a guy's laying in a bed with his liver out to here and his skin is yellow and his eyebrows are yellow, and he will not go to your AA meeting. I'm not a damn alcoholic. Get that crap out of here. and you come back next month and he's dead, and there's a new guy in the bed saying he's not an alcoholic. Now, if a guy 4 days away from death from acute alcoholism can prove he's not an alcoholic, you and I sure can if we let our minds drift to it. And that's what's so difficult to understand here, because my mind would like not to be channeled into this type of thing. My mind would like to be free, and if it got upset, to have a few drinks, because it brings almost instant pleasure temporarily. And that's why it's so difficult to accept alcoholism, why many people die from it. Because after all this happened, you may say, but you don't understand, you see, my problems really came when I was sober. That's when it hurt so bad. I just had a few drinks to ease off and got a little out of hand. Nobody seems to understand that. And then he's just defined the disease of alcoholism. Now, how do you overcome it then? How do you overcome it? You stop drinking. We've all stopped drinking. We've all clenched our fists sometimes. I put my hands on my son's casket and stopped drinking. Drank again. Why? Because alcoholics of our type cannot live sober. So there's only two ways that can happen. I can't change sobriety. I can't change the world. So what can I change? I can change my perception of it. But that sounds stupid. That sounds like some self-help book. You're going to make you all better. And it's very hard to accept that premise, except for one thing. There are literally millions of people who have felt the way you and I do, who are living sober in the world, that according to any description of any psychoanalytical study, cannot be sober. And how have they stayed sober? Have they become suddenly strong and willing to take unending pain? Not at all. There's something here that changes it. Now, it's hard to believe. If I were sitting here, I wouldn't believe it. I didn't believe it. But I was driven to take the actions by pain, and much to my surprise, it worked for me as well. I say I was in and out of AA for 10 years, but let me tell you something. The first time I did AA, it worked. That means more than sitting here, learning the words, memorizing some of the phrases, being cute, discussing things, and discussion means you have no idea what that's all about. The theory that makes AA work is this. It is action. You act yourself little by little better, which would seem easy, except the actions are not actions you would accept or take. You would think, well, that's all very nice, this action philosophy. Maybe I need to go to a psychiatrist who could help me. And I'm sure it seems that way. I always thought that. Because psychiatrists have a rational and reasonable approach to problems like mine. You come to us, we will change your thinking, and eventually your actions will change. Sounds right to me. These well-meaning people today, nice people, but kind of simple, they say things like, oh, you come to us and we'll change your actions and eventually your thinking will change somehow. I don't think you understand, pal. Unless you could stay here long enough to realize these well-meaning amateurs have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of sober alcoholics, and the psychiatrists do not have one. Not one that I know of. It is not because we're magic or mystical, but it turns out this book written in 1939 by a guy who could not stay sober has changed more alcoholic lives in the past 60 odd years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. Now, how does it do this? Is it somehow magic? What makes it almost magic is that every one of those cases have felt to one degree or another the same way you and I have. My case is different. You don't understand. My problem really isn't drinking. Doesn't anybody know? Because it deals with emotions way beneath the surface. I've been active now. I'm sober in AA something over 40 years. Not as long as some people. But I look a lot younger, too. But I've been active all these years. And since I've been active, I had the opportunity to do things that some people haven't had a chance to do yet. The last few years, I've been asked to come and speak in Cape Town and Durban and Johannesburg and Berlin and London and Rome and Belfast and Oslo and Sydney and Auckland and a lot of places all over Europe. Last week I was in Canada and all these places. And you'd think you'd find exotic AA in application. But if you're new, let me tell you something funny. Except for the accents, you hear exactly the same feelings you hear in this group before the meeting or after. Every group in the world, as far as I know, seems to boil down to this at the bottom. There's a group of people who have come, whether by pain or direction, have been led into taking actions that have changed their perceptions, enabled them to live somewhat comfortably. There's another bunch who cannot or will not take these actions and criticize and sneer at the people who do. And there's newcomers in the middle. And both of these groups fight for their souls. And it's amazing we get as many as we do. Because we ask them to take actions that don't make sense. And these people are saying, don't take these actions that don't make sense. And yet, that's what AA is about. And that's what makes you understand how much AA works. It works at a level. It works for a sober African bushman in Natal, as well as it works for me. And none of us have anything in common with him. But it's the same thing, because it deals with human emotions, and in some cases those human emotions are somehow chemically or anatomically somehow assuaged by alcohol, unlike most bodies. And if it does this for you, you will eventually use it to cope with conflict, and eventually it will become overpowering, and then you'll be in that situation where I can't drink, and the conflicts are even worse. And that's why we ask you to come to AA, not to learn a few phrases. This isn't like learning some rote subject matter, learning how to run a computer. This is considerably more difficult. But it's quite simple. Now, John accuses me of making it complex. It sounds complex, but it is so simple. Most of us come here with such complex thinking processes, we can't believe it can be that simple, so we have to make it more complicated. But if you stay here a while, it gets simpler and simpler and simpler. And the 12 steps read tonight are wonderful. In 1950, they had the first international convention of AA and AA. They thought it was going to be the only one. They got people together to try to get them to accept the concept of the traditions, because the AA was coming apart. They needed the traditions to survive. But one of the things that happened at that convention was the co-founder, a man named Dr. Bob Smith. I talked to him. His son called me yesterday. We had a nice chat. He's a nice man. Lives in Texas. But his father, Dr. Bob, was dying of cancer. And they said, well, Bob, you probably wouldn't want to participate. Oh, he said, oh, I would. I'm the second longest sobriety in the whole world behind Bill. He said, I want to say something. So they helped him to the podium. And he got up to me, very sick. I have a tape of that. And he said, I want to thank you all for coming here. And I hope, so nice to see you. I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in your hometown that what we're doing here. He said, I hope you'll pardon me. I've seen that my health hasn't been as good as I want it to be. And for the last 3 or 4 months, I've been much of the time in bed. He said, but I would indeed be remiss if I didn't call to your attention 2 or 3 things. And then he said something which, in my opinion, made that short talk the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. It truly is the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. It sifts away all the complexities. He said, first, keep the program simple. Let us not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, is love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. Secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with love and kindness. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like this who doesn't know exactly what he means. Because we're like the little girl with a curl in the middle of her forehead. When we're good, we're very, very good. But when we're bad, we're horrid. And we got to try to overcome that. And finally, he said, let us never be too busy to stop and give a pat on the back to the man behind us. Maybe take him to a few meetings. Let us never reach that stage of smug indifference where we are too busy to help those who brought us here, who are yet to come, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't done it for us. Then he said a few closing remarks, and he sat down, and he was dead shortly thereafter. So if you're new tonight, I've talked a lot about drinking and sickness and throwing up and nonsense. But if I can leave you with something, let me leave you. Keep it simple. Don't worry about the Freudian complex. They've never worked for people of our type. Find someone who you can trust and allow them to superimpose actions over your perceptions. Try to guard that erring member of the tongue and try not to criticize and judge, become too bitter. And even after you're here just a short time, find someone who's here a little shorter time than you. Give them a pat on the back. Have a cup of coffee with them. Start to understand that's the nature of the beast here. AA is not designed to make you sober. AA is designed to cross that door and live in the world with some degree of dignity. And I hope you find it. Thank you.